when I go on a trip, my kids always make sure that I've got the jump drive in the car, and they do that for three reasons. For my little girl, it's the Beatles, and for my little boy, it's Good Vibrations, and for both of them, it is American Pie. They both love the song.
Oh, wonderful.
And now the author and the writer and the singer of American Pie, Don McLean, is bringing his song, not only American Pie, of course, but his entire catalog to Clues Hall on the campus of Butler University in Indianapolis on May 1st, and he is joining us now. So, Don, it's fantastic to talk to you, and I'm just wondering, it was American Pie. Was that something you worked on for years, or was that one of these things that came to you very quickly?
Well, it took about 3 months to write, and but it was a long time percolating, because I wanted to write a big song about America, and I had been thinking about the Buddy Holly tragedy for many years. It was something that haunted me, and so it all came together around 1969 or 70. And there's going to be a movie actually made. It's a documentary about the making of that song, and I know people have heard me do these interviews for years, and every time I ask these questions, they probably roll their eyes. I can understand that, but I also realize that people want to know these things. So what we've done is gone ahead and there's a 90-minute documentary that's going to come out about everything having to do with where I was and how I did what I did and who influenced me and all that stuff. And there's also a bookazine that's around, which also talks about the same subject matter and how the song was created.
And you were, and if I may go into it just a little bit, I know that you got the documentary coming out, but you were influenced by people like Pete Seeger. You were singing about environmental causes for years, 15 years before Sting was doing it. And you even had an album come out in 1969. You beat Carole King to the punch. It was called Tapestry.
Correct.
The big song on there was Castles in the Air, which I have that album and have listened to it many times. But then you end up, as you say, very deliberately composing American Pie, and it comes out in 1971. And I just wonder, when you finish writing a song like that and you look at yourself in the mirror, what do you say? You say, my God, I've really done something?
Well, the record turned out really well because of the producer, Ed Freeman. He did a great job. Are you still there?
Oh, yes.
Okay. And so together we made this album, and a lot of things happened at once because, you know, I'm not really a calculating type of a guy. I'm more of a pure artist, I suppose you might say. And there was quite a bit of luck because United Artists Records bought the little record label that put Tapestry out. And I might want to say that Tapestry, the title song of the record, was an environmental song. But anyway, they loved the song, and they pushed it right on to number one. They made a short version of it, and so we had that going for us, you know, money behind the record, which we didn't have with the other record company. So that started the ball rolling, and it went international. And then I made a third album called Don McLean, and all three albums were on the charts at once. So you can imagine what that must have been like.
Well, that must have been kind of a monumental point in your life and career to have that happen.
Sure never happened again, I'll tell you that.
I wonder now, because, you know, I've seen a lot of YouTubes of some of the early TV appearances or some of the TV appearances around the time of American Pie and Vincent, and you were a singular performer at the time. You had just you and a guitar. And I wonder how long it took you to finally kind of acquiesce and go less folky and have a band with you whenever you toured.
Well, I was evolving. I wanted to accomplish that because I loved so many kinds of music, but I really loved Pete Seeger a lot, and I wanted to do a solo thing like he did. And so I did that, you know, pretty much throughout the 70s when I was at my most popular. And then I began to have hits with songs like Since I Don't Have You and Crying, and, you know, which had voices and strings and everything. So I started to work on creating a group, and Tony Migliori was the first person that I used. Well, I actually used one guitar player for a good long period of time named John Platania, who was a regular with Van Morrison, and we had a whole career, 15 years. And then I started building the group with piano, guitar, and drums and bass, and then bigger things happened. You know, I was then playing Glastonbury and Stagecoach, all these massive festivals. But you know, people at these shows come to hear the music, and that's why they're so wonderful. You know, a lot of times you have subscription concerts and so on where people just think, oh, well, I'll go see this or I'll go see that. And they may not be committed that much to hearing the music, but in the festivals, the kids are all there, and they're having a wonderful time, you know, hearing different artists. And so you could probably go solo, and they wouldn't mind either. You know, they like it.
And you have played all different sizes of venues. I recall seeing you, I think, in 2013 at a 1,000-seater down in Mississippi at the Riley Center there. And it was just the exact same size show, I think, that you played when you played Glastonbury, which I recalled seeing later, you know, clips of on YouTube. When you guys play, you put just as much into it, no matter what size venue you're in or what size crowd.
Well, that's being a professional. I mean, you have to. But as far as that goes, if you give me enough of a sound system and the speakers are loud enough, I can play anything. A stadium, it's as easily as playing in the living room. It all has to do with amplification and moving a lot of air. And that's the key. But the thing is that today, these young acts, some of them, well, if you look at like Taylor Swift and Ed Sheeran, who are really major people right now, they couldn't be more different, because Ed just goes on stage with a little nothing and a guitar and plays to 90,000 people. And Taylor has to go and do a huge production, which she does tremendously well, and she makes these amazing videos. But it's a whole different thing, you know, and a heck of a lot more expensive to bring that kind of a show around than to just go on stage with a guitar. So both things are alive and well out there. You know, you can decide what it is you like to do. I'm sure that people with the big show love doing it.
I think the impression that I get is that probably you have more in common, you know, as far as the intimacy of the music with Sheeran than you do Taylor Swift.
Yeah, well, I don't dance that well, so. But no, they're both fantastic, but I'm just saying there's room for everything now. You know, there's the big show, and then there's also the, but when he plays, it's loud, it's big, it's huge, you know, and the audience is satisfied and hears every word. So it's really the sound system and the power of that that allows you to control any size audience.
I think we have to address the pandemic and coronavirus, and I just want to do that by asking what you've been doing, because the news release that we got from your company says that you're now going back out on the road. Has it been a thing where you've just been kind of sitting there waiting for this thing to subside?
No, I've been on the road for 50 years, so I was delighted to be home. It didn't bother me one bit. What bothers me is to see all the people who want to bring me and present me in their halls and in their theaters have to reschedule and move things around. And, you know, it's very tough on all these venues, and it hasn't gotten a lot easier. You know, Genesis was around. They had to cancel a bunch of shows. That's bad. You know, that hurts the venues. But they had to because of this virus thing. And now they're back, I think, doing some more shows. Well, I hope that doesn't happen, but you don't know. I'm going to really start off in Hawaii in January, and then take it one step at a time. But I think we are developing coping mechanisms in order to handle this pandemic, which will allow things to move forward, not as smoothly as they once did, but still have forward movement. So that's what I think. And I think this latest wrinkle is not as bad as we thought it might be.
It is seeming that way. One date I noticed on your itinerary is pretty significant, and that is playing the Surf Ballroom on February 3rd. And if people don't know what date that is, that's the date. And also the last place that Buddy Holly and Ritchie Valens and the Big Bopper played before they went off into the sky, and then their plane crashed there in near Mason City, Iowa. The Surf Ballroom was the last place they played. Have you played the surf before? And will playing there on February 3rd be a big thing for you?
Well, I'm looking forward to doing that. And when I played there many years ago, it was a kind of a homecoming for a lot of different people that were associated with Buddy Holly. It was a very magical evening. They had the Fireballs there. They had Ritchie Valens' son was there. Donna was there. Peggy Sue was there. Nikki Sullivan, who left the Crickets, was there, who I always wondered, you know, what he did. It turns out that he left the Crickets to join IBM and a whole lot of other people were there. And a man was there who Waylon Jennings was there, a whole bunch of people. The Blue Caps, you know, Gene Vincent's groove, and those guys were, I think, firemen. At that time, they weren't musicians anymore, but they got on stage and just ripped it up. I mean, they were really good. But they were actually professional firemen at that point. And so it was quite an evening. And one of the – there's a family called the Picks, P-I-C-K-S, that they used to do – the background voices for Buddy's records down there in New Mexico, you know, like if, you know, you hear Buddy Holly do that makes it tough. there's a quartet that comes, time goes by, I'll still remember you. And that makes it tough. He comes in. Well, those voices are the Picks. They were a family. I met him. He was a really nice guy. And they did a beautiful job. They did not sound like the Jordanaires. They were different. And so they gave Buddy's records a little different feel than the Nashville sound. So, yeah, I did. It was a long answer, but I did. And it was a very wonderful appearance. Probably, I guess it was in the 90s sometime. I don't remember.
Yeah, that would have to be, I guess, before 2002 if Waylon was there.
Well, they fixed the place up and they've made it a really going concern. However, this pandemic, like, you know, so many other venues out there, you have to have people coming. You have to have activity. Otherwise, these places seize right up because it's a weekly thing where they have to have acts coming through, you know, and making a little cash flow so you can pay the taxes and the heat and everything else. So it slows everything down when you don't have this kind of the kind of appearances by artists that you need.
Got any notions to record anytime soon?
I have a new album. One of the things I've done during the pandemic, other than start my website, which is a Don McLean YouTube website, and put a lot of video material up on that. I also uploaded 11 albums and 173 tracks that had previously been unavailable because they were out, and then they reverted to me. They now have a home, and I created this new album called American Boys, and that's going to come out next year. And also did a little Christmas project. I took 12 of my favorite Christmas recordings and had them remixed, and in some cases put some different players on because there was some things I didn't like, and that's probably going to come out next holiday.
Interesting. I you know, one of the albums that I was sitting in a radio station one time, I guess it was probably 15 years ago, and I got this package in the mail, and I opened it up, and it was Don McLean Sings Marty Robbins. And I looked around and I put that under my arm and I took it home, and I kept that one for myself. I have listened to it several times. It's interesting to hear your interpretation sometimes of other people's work. A songwriter who is so singular in his own songwriting and own voice, singing the ballads of Marty Robbins. That was just a unique project.
I related to Marty Robbins musically because He was country, he was rock and roll, and he was pop. And I'm not country, but I am rock and roll and pop and also folk. And he was folk too, because he loved those Western songs, you know. And but he would do, you know, Among My Souvenirs, which is a straight up pop song that Nat Cole would do, or Sinatra. And and then, of course, he was a songwriter, and his biggest song was the epic El Paso, which I do on that record, and I do it in shows sometimes. But, you know, like everybody else, if I hear Elvis Presley do And I Love You So, he does it so beautifully and so much better than I could ever do it. So it's always interesting for me to hear something I wrote done by someone else. For example, when George Michael did The Grave to protest the invasion of Iraq, which he's the only person who made a peep when that all went down. I was very disappointed in my country for doing that, for having only one person have the nerve to stand up. And he chose my song, The Grave. He sang it so much better than I did, and did it so dramatically. It was brilliant. So I really, it makes you understand an artist's talent who maybe you're not really listening to their regular music, but when they do your song and they do it so beautifully, you realize, wow, you realize how much, you know, talent they actually really have. I mean, when Ed Sheeran does Vincent, he does a beautiful job. When James Blake does Vincent, which is just with the piano, and he's sort of cutting edge, a whole different kind of music, but boy, he sings that so well.
Listen at the modesty. we could probably talk about Vincent, you know, for another 20 minutes or so. An incredible song in its own right. But I do want to remind everybody that you will be at Clues Hall on the campus of Butler University on May 1st. Tickets are already on sale for that. And it's just another one of the, a kind of a series of comeback concerts. There's going to be at least three concerts in 3 days, I think, there at Clues Hall. So that's an incredible feat for that venue. Are you talking to us from New Rochelle this morning?
Oh, no. I haven't lived in New Rochelle since I was 17. No, I'm out in California, right near Palm Springs.
Okay, so you're not experiencing any of the winter chill, as it were.
No, and I don't want to. That's why I'm here. I did that for many years. I lived in Maine. I still have property in Maine and go back there frequently, and I'm a resident of Maine. But I plowed my driveway. I've done it all, you know, for years and years. I had horses there. And now I'm kind of in this – I happen to be out here at this other property that I love, and when the pandemic hit. So I didn't leave, except for a few times. And it's been a whole other way of life that I've enjoyed a lot.
Well, we can't wait to see you here, and I look forward to it. And I thank you for taking the time to talk to us today.
Well, I enjoyed it.
All right, Don McLean, singer-songwriter and author and singer and the purveyor of the American phenomenon that is American Pie. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.